Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The title of this talk is 12 Thomistic Rules for Managing Appearances and Making Yourselves Miserable. Although it might not be obvious from the title, the topic that I was given to speak on is leadership. I opted for the snarky title rather than something straightforward like a Thomistic account of leadership for three reasons. First, I couldn't resist some harmless, superficial imitation of Jordan Peterson. Second, I didn't want to use the word leadership because it seems to me that very few of us know what we mean when we use that word. We probably have a handful of slogans that we associate with leadership, but we also probably haven't thought about what acting on those slogans would really look like. More on that shortly. Third, St. Thomas doesn't explicitly mention anything about leadership. And even if the TI does permit people to say things that aren't explicitly Thomistic, I still feel obliged to ground my remarks somehow in St. Thomas. This brief backstory behind the title is also a kind of menu for the talk itself. Thus, after distinguishing between what's commonly referred to as leadership and what I'm going to insist on calling initiating working well with others, in part one, I'll give an account of what it means to work well. First on our own, and then with others. In part two, I'll note 12 reasons why we fail to work well with others, or 12 ways we fall into managing appearances and making ourselves miserable. And then in part three, I'll suggest a few things we can do to secure ourselves against those 12 failures, or at least against some of them. Without further menuing, here's the longer explanation of why I'm using the awkward phrase initiating working well with others rather than leadership. There's a magnet high school a few blocks from the convent that calls itself a leadership academy. In theory, this school is full of leaders, no followers. I suspect that the administration of the school genuinely wants to make its students leaders. I also suspect the administrators of the school present leadership as something inherently good. But on the basis of what you might have seen them doing outside during your lunch break, I'm not convinced that the students really want to be leaders. I suspect this is partially due to a lack of clear, actionable account of what leadership is. This is what I suspect that the students, and maybe also the administrators, take leadership to be. A leader is a hero, a model, who inspires imitation. More specifically, a leader is a mover and a shaker, someone who gets things done without waiting for things to be handed to him. He's inclined, either by temperament or effort, to be at the front of the line. He might be competitive with others, but above all, he's competitive with himself. In this, he inspires imitation, and the imitators are his followers. While there's nothing necessarily wrong with being a hero or being at the front of the line, I do think there's something incomplete with this as an account of leadership. One thing that is misleading, is that it suggests that leadership is a quality that exists in certain human beings, even when they're sleeping. I would prefer to say that leadership doesn't exist at all, but only the activity of leading. And leading only exists when someone is leading someone else in doing some activity. Another misleading thing about this hero account of leadership is that it presents the leader as fundamentally passive. The hero doesn't actively invite involvement, but passively attracts others to imitate him. The hero might even be oblivious about the existence of his many or his few imitators. A third misleading thing about the hero account of leadership is that it's not very practical. It's one thing to want to be a hero, but another thing to take the practical steps of becoming one. Be a hero isn't immediately actionable. So after my hopes at arriving at a robust account of leadership by observation of the local populace were dashed, I turned my attention to Thomas Stottle. I turned my attention to St. Thomas's commentary on Book 3 of Aristotle's Politics. I take this account to be his anachronistic response to our contemporary notions of leadership. Thomas Stottle asserts that in the ideal city, the ruler is the person who is most prudent. Unlike the city blacksmith, who only needs to be prudent about his own affairs, the prudence of the ruler must extend to the affairs of the whole city. To rule is to guide the work of the city as a whole, without neglecting or supplanting the work of the city's parts. I understand this to mean that the ruler must initiate bringing his agency, that's to say his work, into relationship with the agency or work of all the others in the city. More succinctly put, the work of the ruler is to initiate working with others. Before turning our attention to what it means to work well with others, let me mention two differences between Thomas Stottle's account of this phrase and what I'm hoping to achieve in this talk. First, I'm not advocating that your titles be changed to chapter rulers. Thank you. Second, there are lots of ways of initiating working with. All of these count as initiating, but only the third kind is the one that I wish to focus on in this talk. A ruler who has an office can initiate the involvement of his subjects in his work by appealing to the subjects' obligation to do so, and perhaps even to the consequences of their non-involvement. A small child trying to bike up a steep hill can initiate an adult's involvement in her work by appealing to her need and to the ability of the adult to fulfill her need. Lastly, and most importantly, Peter can initiate the involvement of Paul and Mary, all of whom are peers, in Peter's work of forming a folk band by appealing to the goodness of the work and also to the goodness of working with him. So, I've defined leading as initiating working well with someone. I've said something about the quality of this initiating. Now I'll say something about what it means to work well in general, how we go about working well on our own, and then how we go about working well with others. Part one, working well with others. First, what it means to work well in general. What I mean by work is that kind of activity which begins with a wish, proceeds by deliberation, and ends in an action. Suppose a few days before Peter invited Paul and Mary to form a band, Peter was sitting on the porch singing to himself and enjoying it. He was resting his attention on the present. As he does so, he imagines doing that always, even into his 80s, but with friends. Traveling around in a VW bus. At first, this wish seems impossible to realize, but Peter allows himself to walk through what, if he had the power, would be enough to realize that wish. Get a VW bus, write some songs, get some band members, get a few more items in a wardrobe. The more he deliberates, the more his attraction to his wish seems to grow. He finds himself excited enough that, without any further deliberating, he walks to the bus stop and heads to where Paul is staying. In response to this scenario, I think Thomas Stottle would make the following observations. First, work as an activity includes all three of these elemental activities in a particular order. The activity of work differs from the activity of rest, because in rest, there's no wishing, no deliberating, and no commanding an action. When you're resting, you already have what you previously wished for. So deliberating and commanding would detract from that rest. Work is all three of these activities in a particular order. Temporally speaking, we always wish first, then deliberate, and then act. But as far as what we're doing each of these things for, We deliberate so that we can command some action. And we command some action so that we can achieve what we wish for. Wishing sets the whole process off, and acting realizes our wish. We can engage in wishing, deliberating, and acting independently from other activities, but doing so doesn't make for work. We can wish for impossibilities, and this never sets off the process of deliberating. For example, we could wish that this room were halfway filled with water and that we all had pool noodles, but we don't deliberate about going about that. Most of us don't. We can also deliberate about what we would do if we were in a situation that we're not presently in. But this doesn't lead to our actually willing the actionable means that we identify in our deliberations. For example, if this room weren't halfway, but almost entirely filled with water, how would you get out? We can command ourselves to engage in certain actions whose goodness is immediately evident to us and which aren't the means to any further wished for end. So for example, if you're in the crosswalk and you see a motorbike flying through a red light, you don't need to wish or deliberate in order to sprint. You still internally command yourself to move, however. Second, to work well means to wish well, deliberate well, and command well. Very well. But what does it mean to do each of these activities well? It seems to me that we have two measures of what doing each of these activities well would mean. First, we refrain from wishing, deliberating, and commanding in a way that distorts our ability to engage in that activity at the present and in the future. So for example, to deliberate well means not to engage in endless deliberation that leads to paralysis. Second, wishing, deliberating, and commanding well means that we refrain from wishing, deliberating, commanding in a way that distorts our abilities to engage in the other activities. So for example, engaging in endless deliberation indirectly limits our ability to wish. If we never get the experience of identifying the means to realize our wishes, we'll be inclined to stop wishing at all. Experientially, both of these ways of not working well show up as passivity and as an absence of hope. When your agency, and by this I mean your ability to wish, deliberate, and command, when your agency is harmed, it's experienced as powerlessness. This is to say, as a lack of agency. So we might say that to work well is to wish in a way that doesn't limit our ability to deliberate, to deliberate in a way that doesn't limit our ability to command an action, and to command in a way that doesn't limit our subsequent ability to wish. Let's get a commentary from Thomas Tuttle on how to go about wishing, deliberating, and commanding well on our own. First, wishing well. To wish is to desire something rationally at a distance. To desire something at a distance means that the thing that we're wishing for isn't presently something that we possess. To desire something rationally is to be attracted to something that we understand to be good, not merely that we perceive with our senses to be pleasant. So for example, I can wish to have surgery, even though it's not pleasant. Also, even though I perceive that the coffee in front of me on the Starbucks mobile order line is pleasant, I don't wish to take it because I know that that would be theft. Maybe I do wish a little bit. Since we can understand as many things to be good as we can attend to, this means that the only thing that limits our wishing is our attention. We can attend to things that are good but impossible, as well as good and possible. We can attend to things that are useful, as well as things that are desirable in themselves. If we've allowed our attention to be fixed on a particular kind of goodness, for example, what will look good on a CV, we will end up limiting our wishing to whatever conforms to that principle. We should be very concerned about limiting our wishing, since our wishing sets the target and thus the limit of all of our actions. We never deliberate except about what we wish to do. and what we perceive to be possible. Also, we never act to attain a wish in the absence of deliberation. So in the most succinct manner, wishing well means paying attention to the good things in our experience, noticing our attraction to them, and remaining free from those things that distort our attention, that incline us not to see genuinely good things. Second, deliberating well. To deliberate is to identify and evaluate the means to the wished for end. In order to do this, you need to reverse engineer the steps that you would take in order to get from where you are to where you wish to be. You start at where you wish to be, and then you ask where you would need to be in order to be almost at that goal. You repeat this until you reach the step that you could take right now. That process reveals to you a possible path from where you are to where you wish to be. But sometimes there are multiple possible paths, and sometimes some of those paths aren't steps that you should take. So, deliberating well includes not only having an accurate sense of where you are right now and where you wish to be, and not only being able to imagine possible means to the end, but also having principles that tell you what kinds of means you should and shouldn't take. It also includes our recognizing when we've reached the step that's within our power to take right now, because otherwise we'd never stop deliberating. I'd like to emphasize the importance of the role that principles, that's to say shoulds and shouldn'ts, have in deliberating well. There are two ways that we can be deficient in our principles. One is not to have the principles that you should have. This is probably not true for anyone who identifies as a Thomist, unless there are any moral relativists in the room. Another way to be deficient in your principles is to have principles that you shouldn't. It's possible for your deliberations to be limited because you're being obedient to a principle that isn't entirely adequate to reality. Or, even more likely, you're disproportionately obedient to one of many principles. If you bind yourself primarily to one principle, such as never do anything that won't look good on a CV, you'll limit both what you wish for, that is what you recognize to be good, and also what you perceive as possible means. To use another example, none of us even pretends to wish to fill the chapel downstairs halfway with water. Why? Because we believe the principle that you shouldn't desecrate a sanctuary. So we don't even hesitate to consider doing this, either as an ends or a means. Third, commanding well. To command is to perform the internal act that suffices for doing the thing that's within our power to do right here and now. To command, in other words, is to will the means that we arrived at in our deliberations. Commanding well tends to follow from wishing well and deliberating well. We wish for what's possible, deliberate about the possible means to that end, and then when we recognize that some means is in our power, we will it. We command that our mouth open and say the thing to the friend that we know is good, even if we're afraid or lack the emotional motivation to do so. Commanding well doesn't just follow from wishing well and deliberating well. It also reinforces our excellence in these activities. If you get used to deliberating and not acting, you'll eventually begin to look upon yourself as powerless. This affects your future deliberations because fewer and fewer things will appear to you to be possible because you've come to believe that your agency is diminished. Downstream from this, the more inclined you are to look upon things as impossible, the less inclined you'll be to wish for them or even notice them. This is the tragedy of getting used to being frustrated. On the other hand, whenever you succeed in commanding your own agency, your sense of your ability to affect things is renewed. What then would it look like to wish, deliberate, and command with someone else? I'll look at each of these activities individually, but we'll first say something about working well with others as a whole. The basic recipe for working well with someone else is, first, wish, deliberate, and command well on your own. Second, articulate these wishes, deliberations, and commands to someone whom you regard as potentially your equal. And third, care about the wishing, deliberating, and commanding of the other as the acts of someone who is potentially your equal. What I mean by caring is to attend to those acts of the other on their own terms, looking for what's good in them, and then to involve yourself and to involve yourself with it and it with you insofar as those acts are good. Put more succinctly, to work well with another is to respect your agency and that of others without compromising either. Let's attempt to demystify this. Wishing well with others. Peter can wish with Mary if he regards her as someone potentially equal to him as a wisher. He doesn't have to know her already to be his equal, but he does need to believe that she at least could be his equal. If he doesn't believe that Mary would understand or recognize the goodness of his wishes, he probably will have some other nefarious reason for articulating his wishes other than working with her. Also, if he doesn't believe that Mary's own wishing is good, he won't be able to let her comments affect his own wishing. If Peter does regard Mary as an equal, he might say something like this. Hey, Mary, can I share a wish with you? I'd like to get off this porch and stop living payday to payday. I regret not realizing this sooner. I'd like to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. Is my wish good? Do you think I can do it? Can you help me think through how to make it real? Deliberating well with others. It's messy. What would it mean for Peter to deliberate with Mary? This probably is not so mystifying as wishing with or even commanding with, because unless you're a hermit, you have several opportunities to deliberate with people. Peter articulates to Mary the possibilities he sees and the principles he has in mind. He also listens to her as one who wishes for the same thing, and yet who might see more possibilities and different principles than Peter has seen. On a side note, one of the signs that someone wishes with you is that he engages in deliberating with you. Someone who doesn't wish with you can, at most, be with you physically or emotionally. More on that later. Commanding with others. There's one sense in which commanding with another is impossible. Peter's internal act of willing is his and his alone. Even if Peter and Mary end up willing the same thing, Peter's willing is Peter's and Mary's is Mary's. In another sense, though, Mary can certainly be with Peter in his commanding. Ideally, she can wish with him, deliberate with him, and support his own exercise of agency by staying neither too close nor too distant from his activity. There are lots of ways of being with someone who is commanding that fall short of this ideal. Mary can be with Peter simply by not actively discouraging him, even if she doesn't do anything to actively encourage him. She could also actively encourage him verbally, but not provide any material means to support his acting. Again, she could encourage Peter and provide material support, but do so primarily because she cares about the result of his acting, and not at all because she cares about Peter's agency. She encourages him merely because he's a means to a further end. Still further, Mary and Peter could be accountability partners, each doing the same thing, and caring that the other exercises his or her own agency, but doing so for very different reasons. Perhaps Peter writes songs because he wants to form a band, but Mary writes songs because she's avoiding paying her taxes. gathering all these observations thus far. To lead is to initiate working with someone. To work is to wish, deliberate, and command. To work with, deliberate with, and command with someone else requires that we view the other as at least potentially our equal, that we articulate our wishes, deliberations, and commands to the other, and that we care about the wishes, deliberations, and commands of the other. To do all of this well means that we respect both our agency and that of the other. And in particular, it means that we attend to what is good, and that we resist attending or doing anything that would distort our agency or that of another. Part 2. 12 ways we fall into managing appearances and making ourselves miserable. Or 12 reasons why we fail to work well with others. I have one prefatory explanation and 2 prefatory warnings. The explanation, which might be 3. First, each of the 12 rules or slogans on this list made it on the list because it seemed to me to be a rule that at least some well-intending people follow. And that when followed as a rule, that slogan limits or distorts the activities that comprise working. That's to say, it limits or distorts our ability to wish, deliberate, or command. Second, my intention in listing these rules isn't to mock them or the people that follow them, but to expose the harm of following them as a rule. The first 8 rules directly erode our ability to wish, deliberate, and command on our own. And the last 4 rules directly erode our ability to work with others. Third, my intention in phrasing the rules in pithy bumper sticker-like phrases or phrases that might have appeared on the wall of your kindergarten library is to make them memorable and therefore practical as a kind of examination of conscience. The downside of pithiness, though, is inaccuracy, so feel free to protest during the Q&A. The first warning of 2 is that this list is not from Thomas Dottle. It's primarily based on my own observations of myself and secondarily based on my observations of my students. Second warning is that this is a satirical list. If you want to get the straightforward rule, that's to say what you should do, add don't to each of them. I'm presenting the satirical list mostly because I committed myself to it in the title of this talk. I kind of regret that. but also partially because it will incline you to think through each rule rather than passively memorizing it or just jotting it down. However, because I'm not very good at maintaining a satirical or ironic posture, in order to confuse things even further, after I announce each rule, I'll explain the real rule. So, buckle in. Rule number 1. Never put off for tomorrow what you can do today. Explanation. We think that working well means not yielding to laziness. This is true, but the slogan conflates laziness with rest. Work is for rest. If we habitually indulge the inclination to attend to the next thing that I could do, the less you will be able to rest your attention on the one thing that's present. The ultimate cost of this is that if you don't enjoy the thing that you've commanded, if you don't rest with it, then you'll begin to despair, since you always only ever allow yourself to look at the next thing, which isn't in your grasp. It's hard to keep deliberating about what seems forever out of your reach, so you eventually stop even wishing for it. What about an application to a TI? After you've finished a TI event, enjoy it. And don't immediately think, what do I need to do for the next one? Rule 2. Never settle for less than better. Explanation of this. One of the ways of being proactive, of initiating work, is to compare the present performance to our past performance. The way to be perpetually proactive is to commit ourselves to never repeating past mistakes and to never not improving in some slight manner. Even though having a relative measure of success sounds more forgiving than having an absolute measure, the drive to optimize, that's to say, to always improve, is in fact exhausting. You're never free to rest in the good that you've done, considered on its own terms. Paradoxically, a commitment to gradual, incremental success almost always leads to paralysis. With each successive success, more and more effort is required to improve. It gets to the point where the only way we can be faithful to our principle of always optimize is not to act at all. Non-success isn't the same as failure. The drive to optimize also inclines us to view everything through a quantifiable lens. The easiest way to measure improvement is by quantifying goodness. But there's a sense in which goodness can't really be quantified. Application to the TI chapters. Don't evaluate everything by numbers. Do what you do not primarily because it's required, but because it furthers in some manner the greatest wish that you have for your chapter. Rule 3. Never say no to a good thing. Explanation. If we want to maximize goodness in the world, it seems reasonable to commit ourselves to encouraging every good thing that's proposed to us. But the problem with saying yes to every good thing is that it requires you to say no to the greatest of things. This no can come about in two ways. First, and more obvious, saying yes to something means attending to it. We can't attend to more than one thing at a time. Multitasking is a myth. And attending takes time, which is limited. So we end up not having the time to do the greatest of things because we're so busy doing good things. Second, and less obvious, it's very satisfying to do good things, even if they're not great things. For example, when I was supposed to be writing this talk, I pruned the rosemary bushes, reorganized a closet, and made several candles. It felt good, because I saw the effect of my agency on matter in a way that I wasn't seeing the effect of my agency in this paper. The danger in doing many good things is that we can spoil our dinner. This is to say, we can become so satisfied with seeing the effect of our agency in these small things that we cease to feel hungry for that greatest of things. Application. When you sit down to plan the semester or year for your chapter, consider what your greatest wish for your campus is. If having fewer events would make it easier for you to realize that wish, say no to those extra events without shame. Rule 4. Follow your passion. What I mean by passion here isn't a wish, but a visceral feeling of excitement. It's the opposite of meh or boredom. The feeling itself is exhilarating enough for us to want to be motivated by it always, or perhaps to think that something is wrong when the feeling isn't present. The primary problem with following our passion, with only acting when you have that special feeling, and at all other times chasing that feeling, is that it causes our wishing to atrophy. Recall that wishing is a rational desire. And note that passionate desire, at least as I take it to mean, is just a sensible desire. A more fundamental problem with following your passion is that it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it gets the mechanics of motivation wrong. We're motivated to act by first attending to something. Whenever we attend, that brings about awareness. Whenever we're aware of something, that elicits some affect. And that affect prepares us for action. So, as an application, rather than waiting to do some good thing in your chapter until you feel passionate about it, commit yourself to doing a thing that you know to be good, and then let yourself enjoy doing it. Rule 5. Be a realist. The explanation for this one is a little complex. I'd wanted to make this rule something un-bumper stickerable, like, think of yourself as either an idealist or a realist, incapable of switch hitting. But that would never fit on a car. There are two problems with this, as far as working well is concerned. First, it presumes that being an idealist or a realist is a stable feature of our identity, and a fixed principle for acting, rather than a description of how we sometimes act. Second, it presumes that realism is preferable, always, to idealism. The problem with taking either idealism or realism as a fixed principle to which we must adhere is that this restricts our deliberation. We become obedient to a principle and we feel shame or unauthentic if we happen not to obey it. The problem with promoting realism over idealism is that both are necessary for deliberating well. An idealist begins with wishes without regard to where he is right now. The idealist is good at the first moments of deliberation, namely at recognizing where he eventually needs to get. The realist begins with where he is right now and limits his wishes on that basis. The realist is good at the last moments of deliberation, at recognizing what can be done right now. As an application, when you're planning for the semester or the year, keep your eyes on both the distant star, what you wish for, and also on the step that you can take here and now, and don't despise either. Rule 6, be an optimist. I'll slightly recycle the previous explanation. There are two problems with identifying yourself either as an optimist or a pessimist. The first is that you set yourself up for being obedient in your deliberations to the principle, I must be an optimist. And the second is that identifying yourself as either an optimist or a pessimist makes it harder to recognize when you have and don't have hope. Optimism and pessimism aren't the same thing as having or not having hope, but they're related and we're apt to confuse them. An optimist, in the absence of evidence, tends to believe that the actionable means exist to the wished-for end. A pessimist, in the absence of evidence, tends to believe that the actionable means don't exist to the wished-for end. Hope, as an affection, and not necessarily as a theological virtue, is attraction to the means to the wished-for end. Hope, in this sense, is always specific. It's a response to these means to this wished-for end. An application. Wish well, and allow yourself to be attracted to the means as they present themselves, and not merely as you're inclined to do so, independently from your attention to that end. Allow yourself to be inconsistent. Rule 7. Dull your knives before you use them. Several years ago, I heard about a company in London that offered to go to, for pay, offered to go to people's houses and dull their knives. The rationale seemed to be that if someone had previously cut herself with her knives, then she would feel more comfortable using dull knives. The principle here is that we can limit the harm we do if we also limit our power. The downside to this is that in intentionally limiting our power, we never get to know precisely how powerful we are. And we also never get to use that power for a greater good, just for dull good. What about application of this to working well? We can intentionally dull our wishes, and we can intentionally dull our deliberations out of fear of somehow hurting or being hurt by wishing big and deliberating boldly. In application, don't limit your choice of speakers to those whose talks you're already inclined to agree with, to topics you're already familiar with, to topics with which your group of friends is already well disposed. Rule 8, harness your fear. When we're attracted to something and begin to wish for it, we can focus our attention either on that good thing or on the possibility of losing it in the future. If we focus on the latter, And if we have some hope of not losing it, we'll drive ourselves to act out of fear. From one perspective, this isn't entirely bad. Fear does motivate us, and it makes sense to harness it as a motivation, since we're unlikely to be freed from all of our fears. The primary problem with allowing ourselves to be motivated by fear is that it distorts our attention. We become habituated to criticizing good things, to following endless what-if scenarios, and this prevents us from resting our attention on what's good and present. This, of course, is the only thing that we'll be doing in eternity. In application, when you find yourself afraid, afraid of being in conflict with your peers, afraid of being shown to be inept, afraid of having a hard conversation, acknowledge the fear, but turn your attention to the good that might come from doing whatever is in your power to do here and now. Rule 9. Ask Google. More and more, we turn to technology in order to maximize efficiency. Efficiency isn't inherently bad, but neither is it inherently good. Efficiency's goodness depends on several factors. It depends on the goodness of the activity in which you're being efficient, so efficiently overeating isn't good. It also depends on whether the activity for which you are being efficient is good. And this requires that you know what specific activity you're saving time for. So, why are you saving time? It also depends on what other good your being efficient replaces. In application to working well, often efficiency comes at the price of working with others. Working with others is slower and sloppier than working alone or in giving the work to a machine. But if we don't need to go fast, and if sloppy is okay, there's something inherently good about working with others. Also, being efficient with machines allows you to leave out of your work different aspects of your own agency. You stop deliberating, for example, because you're allowing a machine to calculate what you should do. In application, don't bother advertising a TI event through email blasts if doing so will give you an excuse not to go knock on doors and issue a personal verbal invitation. Rule 10, do the dirty work yourself. We want to encourage people to work with us, and very often we recognize that the difficulty of work might be a barrier to some people's involvement. So, we understandably commit ourselves to making their involvement as easy as possible by taking away everything that would be distasteful to them. In application to working well, however, if you deprive people of the opportunity of doing hard work, you deprive them of the gratification of experiencing their agency. Depriving them of hard work can be manipulative. Sometimes commitment to this rule of doing the dirty work yourself stems from a lack of trust in the free agency of the other. They'll never do something because it's good, but only if it's easy. Commitment to this rule can also stem from a disproportionate concern for the other's comfort. We tend to care more, occasionally, about irritating another person than about allowing him to be intimately involved in work. In application, if you're holding a seminar with a speaker, resist the urge to advertise the seminar as no need to pre-read, just show up. Don't set the limbo bar too high. Rule 11. If you're seated next to a child or someone acting like one, put his mask on first. So I know that airlines say the opposite of this, in this case, they're right. Why is it that airlines need to say this, though? It's because something in all of us still believes that we should help the little kid breathe before we breathe ourselves. Setting aside the specific case of being at 40,000 feet without oxygen, in general, we should distinguish between the work that we are obliged to do for ourselves and the work that would be good, but not strictly obligatory, to do for others. Some of the time, the childish person genuinely needs help. But most of the time, we should ask ourselves, is this thing that I'm doing for him something that he can and should do for himself? We should also ask ourselves whether what seems to be working with someone is in fact doing for him what he can and should do for himself. In practice, we can recognize the line between these by noticing the effect of our help on the other person's agency and on ours. Is the childish friend growing in his own agency through your help? Is your own ability to wish, deliberate, and command your own affairs taking a backseat? In application, when you delegate a task to someone for a TI event, don't hover over him and neglect your own tasks. Rule 12. Prioritize emotional connections. Feeling an emotional connection with someone, and by this I mean feeling the same thing as another and letting that be recognized, is good. What isn't necessarily good is prioritizing this way of being with someone over the other, more fully human ways of being with. In some cases, the only way for Peter to be with Mary might be for him to be with her emotionally or to be with her physically. Peter and Mary can be with each other emotionally whenever they have the same emotional response to something. This emotional connection doesn't require that they wish, deliberate, or command with each other, but only that they passively respond in the same way. Contrast this connection with how alone you feel if you're watching a movie that everyone else thinks is funny or sad, and you think it's contrived or manipulative. Peter and Mary can be with each other physically, even in the absence of being with each other emotionally. This is what we tend to call a ministry of presence. All that's required is that you wish the other person's good, even if you don't know what that good is. The danger of prioritizing emotional connection over wishing with, deliberating with, and commanding with is that our agency is more fully expressed in those free acts than in our emotional responses. In application, commiserate with fellow TI chapter rulers, but approach this as a means to working with them. I'll conclude this list of rules with two clarifications. First, if any of these rules has hit upon something in your experience, I recommend that you remember the Pythi rule as a way of securing your wish to be more free. However, if having a list of rules makes you focus on the rules, then consign them to forgetfulness. The goal for the rules is to make you more free, and they do this best when they become the transparent frame within which you act. Second, even though this talk is obviously sponsored by the TI, the rules that I've offered are by no means condoned by the TI, nor are they the expectations of the TI for you as chapter leaders. The TI wishes for its chapters to be genuinely student-led, and I suspect to be led in the manner that I've described above. But the TI certainly doesn't demand this as something owed to the TI. So if you're going to strive to work well with others, do it because it will make you and others more free and less isolated. Don't do it simply in order to check a box to say that you did what was asked. The final part 3. What to do if we wish to avoid living according to these 12 rules. 3 brief practices. First, before working with strangers or enemies, practice working with friends. By a friend, I mean someone who wishes generally for the same thing as you do, and who cares enough about you that he's willing to wish, deliberate, and act to bring about your good, so you can trust him. A friend is more than merely a means to your overcoming your distrust of your own agency and that of others, but a friend is a means of this kind. When we affect a friend and are affected by him, there is a healing effect on us both. If you happen not to live near anyone who fully satisfies this description of a friend, associate yourself with whoever most nearly satisfies it. Perhaps the person is superior to you in some manner, and perhaps he's inferior. Fine. Keep your attention on what is good in him and you, and rest in and work with that. Second practice. After you've gotten good at working with friends, practice being with friends in leisure. Here, you're resting in the possession of something that you wish for in common. Doing this will deepen your love for what you wish and will strengthen your trust in those who wish with you. It's also a foretaste of heaven and a good reminder that all work is ultimately for rest. Third, before, during, and after you've done these first two things, practice surrendering to God. Specifically, surrender to the Holy Spirit each of the abilities mentioned above. Ask the Holy Spirit, which is the Spirit of Emmanuel, God with us, to direct your attention. Allow him to rest your attention on what is good, what is wish-worthy. Allow him to move your attention to things in your memory, to principles, and to one principle more than another. Allow him to move you to act, even in the presence of fear, and thus to act in you and through you. Being with the Holy Spirit, of course, is valuable in its own right. It's also valuable as a means to growing in our ability to work with fallen human beings. And similarly, learning how to work with human beings can be a kind of sacrament for us, giving us a sign of how to be with the Holy Spirit. The reason why these two ways of being with support each other is that we're apt to make the same mistake regarding our agency and the agency of God or another human being. We're apt to think that it's either me or the other who acts. But this is the error that the name and the presence of Jesus, God with us, dispels. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.